Welcome, everybody. Thanks for being at the Boston Book Festival. This is our 15th anniversary, and I'm so excited to welcome you to this session on memoir called Life Lessons. My name is Jeannie Blasberg, and I serve as the co-chair of the board of the Boston Book Festival. And I support the Boston Book Festival because of amazing panels like this one and my desire to see them continue on free to the public far into the future. So if you found yourself enjoying yourself today, please think about going online and making a donation, large or small. We rely on those to keep this festival ongoing and free to the public. In addition, we have a membership booth outside the library, and if you become a member today, there's a free swag thank you bag that you can take advantage of. After this session, books will be sold by the authors, and they'll be available to sign them in the next room. So please buy plenty of books and take advantage of having access to these great authors today. And so now I'm so pleased to introduce the moderator of today's session, Alicia Onstead. She is a professor of narrative journalism at Harvard.
Thank you, Jeannie. Thank you so much. And thank you, just to pause for a moment and say thank you to all the volunteers who are in this room and all around Boston today, and also to our tech team, wherever you are. I can't quite see you, maybe in a booth. Thank you for making this as accessible as possible for everyone in the room today. And thank all of you for being here. I mean, you had a million things you could do in Boston today, and here you are with us. The world is blowing up, and here you are with us because you're readers and fans of writers, and I can't thank you enough for being here today. So hooray for all of you for being here. I'm really honored to be talking with these three writers today whose works I recommend you read if you haven't already for all sorts of reasons that I hope you'll identify with and connect to in the course of our conversation today. So we'll just jump right in. I'll tell you, I'm not going to read bios. I'm assuming that all of you have a program that you can read, but I will ask each person, and this is probably the only question I'll ask, maybe one or two of each of them, to tell us what they want to know about them in their professional careers and perhaps beyond that, because we are in the realm of memoir. So, Josh, would you introduce yourself and tell us what we need to know?
Hi, I'm Josh Barkin. I've written three books of fiction, and this is my first book of nonfiction, the memoir Wonder Travels, that I'll be reading from a little bit today. And I guess the only other thing is I was very pleased to have a fellowship from the National Endowment for the Arts.
Great. Kelly.
Kelly McMasters. My book is The Leaving Season, a memoir and essays. It's my second memoir, and I was doing a podcast with somebody whose son that morning said, can someone write two memoirs? Which I think would be a great thing to talk about today, because yes, the answer is yes. And I think the other important things are that I am a mom of two and a professor of nonfiction only. I read fiction, but I can't write it. I wish I could. And that I am a former bookseller. So thank you to the folks selling the books out there.
And Curtis.
Hi, my name is Curtis, Detroit born and LA-based writer. I have my first debut memoir called Everything I Learned. I learned in a Chinese restaurant. But I do write professionally. I do TV and film. And so we just got over a strike, so happy to go back to work over there.
Yay.
But yeah, in terms of what I want you to know, I'm getting into nonfiction recently. I also have a piece in Bon Appetit that got selected for Best American Food Writing. Yeah. And so I've suddenly become like this food writing expert, even though I can't cook. So that's the thing. So.
But you come from a long line of people who can.
Yes, right. I'm surrounded by food. I can tell you what it looks like and describe it, but that's about it.
So I want to just kind of generally ask you, and you can, you know, if you relate to this question, just jump in. You know, how do you know you have a story to tell and that your story will be relatable to everyone in this room or most people in this room? Kelly, you're nodding. Do you want to kick us off?
Oh, gosh. I was like, great.
That'll teach you to nod.
I want the answer from those folks. Yeah, I think you never really know. You can hope. But I think I know that I'm ready to write an essay in particular. That's the form that where I'm most comfortable when usually two or three things are knocking around in my brain that hit the same emotional resonancy, and I don't understand why. And so I go to the page to sate that curiosity and figure out and ask a lot of questions. When something's uncomfortable, that's when I know I need to go to the page. And then usually after two or three drafts, I figure out the question I'm trying to answer, and if that question feels like something that would relate to other people. So not what's happening in the essay, but the question that's driving the essay, that's where usually I can figure out, okay, I think other people have experienced loss. Other people have experienced shame, even if they haven't experienced it this way.
Mm-hmm. Discomfort is such an important element for a writer, right? I mean, you kind of know if you're a writer, if there's discomfort, you got to lean into it. Mm-hmm. You know, there's something happening there that's pushing you toward that. And just before we go on to you, Curtis, I know you have something to say on this too. Kelly, I want to ask you, since you've edited other essayists, I wonder if you found yourself in this book in particular using the same critical thought that you try to get out of the other people you work with as an editor. Were you able, or is one able to be an editor of one's own work that way?
I wish. I think often I would recognize when I would stop on a page or be hiding on the page, and my editor would say something to me, and I would think, oh, I just told another writer that same thing. I know what I have to do, but it's really hard. But when someone else is there to hold you accountable, I can't write without an editor. I think it's impossible.
Yeah, it's hard to do. I find myself hat on.
Yes.
Yeah, thank you. Curtis, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to answer the first question.
Yeah,
is that okay? This book actually took me a long time to write, so I don't know if that makes you guys feel good. It took me about 10 years. And so for the first many years, it was really just going to be a family comedy, sort of like the TV stuff I do, about my mean grandmother and my grandfather who ran the Chinese mafia. But that book wasn't selling, right? And so I had to take a step back and say, like, well, you know, why can't I even find an agent? And it's that when I thought back, it's like, okay, so we all think that we've had interesting lives, which is hopefully true. We all think we can put together two sentences, which is also hopefully true. But what I wasn't thinking about was, why is this story important to tell now? And why am I that person to tell that story? And once I figured that out, you know, then I had like multiple offers from agents, you know, the book sold in a bidding war. And so I think it was just figuring that moment out. And you know, that timing was, you know, the George Floyd murder, but also the rise in anti-Asian hate crimes, and then realizing that if I talk about those issues, about my own upbringing, how I addressed issues of, you know, being Asian in a very black and white city, but the coming out process, once I started figuring that out, then, you know, it became, you know, a hot property, I guess.
Was that a hard pitch for you to develop? I mean, I think, I don't know if any of you have had the experience of having to come up with a pitch to convince an editor, whether it's at a journal or a newspaper or a book publishing company. Was that a hard pitch for you to actually develop? Because you had to mine some pretty personal stuff.
Yeah. Was it hard to come up with the pitch for it?
Yeah, the pitch. Just the writing of the pitch. Because I feel like selling yourself through a pitch is always so hard.
Well, the pitch that I actually have that I said to my agent was that we live in a very divided world right now, right? People don't talk to each other. We have the little silos. But Chinese restaurants are actually one of the few places where you can actually go in and see somebody from a different race, class, or sexual orientation, whatever. And I want people to take that opportunity, you know, to have conversations with each other. And so it's sort of like, come for the egg rolls, but stay for the talk on racism. So that was my pitch, you know.
Okay, yeah. Okay, I'm going to remember that. Okay. Josh, how about you? Do you want to jump in?
Well, I was going to say that the two questions that you asked, in a way, come together. When do you know you have a story, and the notion of discomfort? This memoir is about when I discovered that my wife of 15 years had an affair during a six-month trip around the world, and meeting a man on the beach in Morocco who I call Mohammed in the memoir. And I guess what I'm getting at is that I think you have a story when you have something of weight, of some kind of real, genuine consequence. And I know a lot of you out there are probably thinking, are wanting to write yourself. And one of the crucial things, is there something there that really truly matters, right? And this hit me like, you know, very shocking. And so that was the kind of weight of the story. But then as far as the kind of discomfort, I think when if there's one thing that I hope is that this memoir, I hope, opens up some space for men to also be able to write about, say, when their wife leaves them. I think a more typical narrative is often, men leaving their wife. And so inherently, there's that question of comfort, discomfort, even notions publicly of what we should be ashamed of. I mean, what have you done as a husband, supposedly, to cause this? And so all those things of both the discomfort and magnitude, I think, can lead you into a narrative.
Yeah, that's so interesting that you say that. It makes me wonder in my mind. Well, first of all, I just want to ask you, how many of you are interested, and you can do a slow raise of your hand on this, in writing a memoir? Look at that, right? Of those of you who have raised your hand, if you're willing to think of one more question, how many of you think you have something that truly matters to talk about? And that can be even those who didn't raise their hand the last time. Anybody? Right? Great. So how do you know that something matters just because it matters to you? And I'm directing that to you.
Yeah, I don't think, in a way, all of our lives matter, right? So we could all write a memoir. We all struggle. We all go through difficulties. So I don't think that there's anyone who doesn't have that within them. But then the bigger issue, whether you're writing fiction or whether you're writing memoir, is always, can you tell your story in a way that both in the writing of it, that it interests other people, and that as you examine your own life, if it is memoir, what are you getting honest enough in your description of what you've experienced so that the truth is recognized by the reader? And I think that's the real challenge. What I'm going to guess all three of us have had to do as we wrote these memoirs is to really go to a place of deep honesty with ourselves, and that's the point at which we can get to that kind of weight and sense of what matters so that you, the reader, can connect with that and feel that sense of, to use that trite word, universality, but to feel that you actually have also gone through something of magnitude.
Yeah, so Josh, since you said a little bit about the trajectory of your book and the theme of it, why don't we start with a reading from you, if you would
Sure, thanks. So I'm going to read a passage from the very near the beginning of the memoir. And this is, as I said, my wife, who I call Luciana in the memoir, she had gone on this six-month trip around the world. And then when she came back to New York City, where we were living at the time, it was clear that something was changed, but she hadn't told me and didn't tell me that she had had this affair. And then a couple months later, she went first to Spain, where she was from. She was a Spanish citizen, ostensibly to see her sister have a baby, but then actually lied and said she was going on to Ibiza, and in fact went back to Morocco to meet Mohammed. This is in the in-between period when I knew something was wrong but didn't know that she had had the affair. It was brave to crack all the tension between us, to lay bare the silence and sadness that had been building for a month and probably for years, but most specifically since she'd come home. But what I felt more than anything was that I was in an extremely delicate and precarious moment, at the mercy of her mood and of what her next decision might be. It turned out a relationship was not a solid thing after all. It turned out that 15 years together was as potentially transparent and as empty as a lie. A life spent together, our entire adult lives, could disappear in an instant with the will of one. For 15 years, I'd worshipped her and devoted myself to her, and yes, sometimes even over-controlled her. And I had spent years making love to her and years teaching her English and driving on road trips and feeling secure and happy as she slept in the seat beside me as I patted her gently when we rolled down the highway as husband and wife, and years with her family in Spain where she felt misunderstood and I tried to explain why she was unhappy to her family, and years kissing her soft lips, and years feeling her gently spooned beside me in bed in the morning together, as soft as the sheets between us, my arms around her, pulling her in slightly tighter until we'd synchronize our breathing, me attempting to breathe more slowly so I could feel the exact pace of her breathing in and out together as one, and all of that, and every day, and picking her up after work almost daily in the summer for long strolls home from downtown Boston to Cambridge, walking over the Charles River Bridge, watching sailboats in the summer sunlight as winds blew off the water and through our hair, or as we forged our way from her office downtown in New York on 23rd Street, where she worked for a magazine, and trudged up Manhattan 86 blocks, exploring side streets and wandering through Central Park, and on weekends as we ambled through the park and looked at birds, and even when we cried together, the way her tears were big, all that stood in her hands, everything, as weightless and destructible as the capriciousness of her instinct and will. It wasn't the memories of our life together that I had at that moment. It was a feeling of fear.
Thank you so much, Josh. Isn't it wonderful to be read to? Oh my God. I missed that from when I was four. So thank you for doing that. You can hear some issues that are coming up that will come up in other parts of our discussion. You know, self-identity, marriage, divorce, deception, belonging, loss, work, family, identity, self-esteem, I might be repeating here. I wonder if we could talk about one of those, and Curtis, I'll come to you now, one of those that was integral to your thinking about the writing that you did, because not all of them overlap in your book, but many of them do. If I had to say, pick one, which is it?
Do you want me to read?
Well, I'd just like you to talk about that first.
In terms of the theme?
Which one of those elements that I mentioned, or another one do you think, I should probably just add justice, just for, to be more inclusive, you know?
Yeah, I mean, so much of my book is about intersectionality, because, you know, as a gay, Asian, Buddhist, working class kid, I was the minority, any checkbox that you did. And so I think it was sort of figuring out how to navigate my life. And also, this idea of home is very important, because I grew up in Detroit in the 80s. It was a very difficult time for my hometown. Not only was the auto industry really struggling, but we had crack cocaine, we had AIDS. I knew 5 people murdered by the time I was 18 years old. But despite that, we had this really wonderful Chinese restaurant where my parents were able to raise the 6 kids and really offer us, you know, the skills necessary to have a really awesome life. And so I think those things, you know, family, you know, home, those are really at the core of it. And how one, you know, being a middle child, how someone fits in with that.
And the complexities of it, not just for you. I mean, we all have complexities in our family lives, right? So it's not your unique hold on that, but it is your unique take on it. Let's hear from your book.
Okay. Cool. I'll read a short piece. So this is actually from the prologue of the book. And so the book is divided into 3 sections of 8 stories each, 8, 8, 8. I don't know, for the Chinese people here, it's good luck. So it's 8 stories in elementary, middle school, 8 in high school, and then 8 in college. And so I'm going to read from the prologue, which really is kind of separate in the sense that it just sets up the family story. So everything I learned in a Chinese restaurant. Welcome to Chung's. Is this for here to go? Armed with a smile and a red waiter's jacket with a perpetual plum sauce stain. That's how my dad greeted any new face who entered the lobby of our popular Chinese restaurant in Detroit. Interestingly, my great-great-grandpa, Gong Li Chin, had faced the same question in the late 1800s as he stood cold and alone on a rickety dock in Guangzhou, China, trying to decide his future and that of his young impoverished family. For here or to go? For here or to go? As I got older, it was a question I asked myself. Starting in our restaurant's long and open back kitchen, where my family made some of our most popular items, including the tangiest barbecue pork and the best-smelling almond cookies, my mom taught me my first lessons. Before diving into math, English, and geography, she began with a little American history, tales of elders and ancestors, our family as prologue. And so it sort of continues, talking about how, like, my great-great-grandfather moved from Canton, China to Canton, Ohio, before realizing there weren't Chinese people there, and then moving up to Detroit to, you know, so they opened the restaurant in 1940, and so then in 1967, Detroit had this thing called the riots, or the rebellion, and so for the first time ever, the restaurant had to close for 5 days, and during that time period, my parents managed to have sex. And I was born 9 months later as their riot baby. And so I feel like that's why I talk about racial justice and social inequality a lot, because without those riots, I wouldn't be born. And so that sort of just sort of sets up the theme of the book. It's like, you know, for here to go, do I stay in Detroit, a city that's literally falling apart, you know, but I love my family and I get all the free food I want, or do I, you know, leave the nest. And I think that's a relatable story that everybody goes through, right? Like, when are you ready to leave, you know, your family?
So. Oh, I think they're in each of your books very relatable human themes, right? Kelly, I wonder if you were listening to that, if it struck you thinking about the role of memory. And I thought about this a lot when I was reading your book, because you're so specific. Your details are like right down to the shoes you were wearing, right? And, you know, I was thinking that, you know, your book has been called a memoir of intimate essays and a divorce memoir. I don't know how they those descriptions land with you, but I wonder if you could talk about contending with the past, which is a memory, right? And the power of retrospect to recreate that past. It's a big question.
So maybe. The idea of trying to do it truthfully?
Yes.
Okay.
I think truth is a word that hovers over memoir a lot.
Right. Right, because whose truth is it? I teach a class called Truth Versus Fact, and it's one of my favorite classes to teach because there's no answer, right? I think, yes, this has been called a divorce memoir, and in order to sell it, we had to use that terminology in the proposal. But I never thought about it that way. Mostly because it's my story. And so, yes, there is this other person on the page that a lot of the narrative pushes against, but it's not about the divorce. The divorce is something that happens in the book, but it's about memory, it's about love, it's about motherhood, it's about identity, so many of the things that you talked about. And I was thinking about Vivian Gornick, who's an amazing writer, and she says it's not what happened to the writer that matters, it's what the writer makes of what happened. And that's, I think, a lot of my book, which is also in three parts. It's a magic number, right? Three acts. And mine are divided by landscape. And so landscape is where I feel comfortable in terms of how to build a story, what lens to use when something is difficult. I feel protected when I can bring landscape in and use that to tell a story through. And so it starts in the city, and then we go to the country, and then we end in the suburbs. And I will say, for me, an interesting part is I'm essentially a single mom in the suburbs, and there are lots of us, and each of us has our own story of how we got there. And that's what I think is really interesting. So not who we are in this moment, but the memories and the way that they mix and the way that we see them, what memories we remember. So many times in my classroom, one or a few students will say, oh, I have a horrible memory. I can't write memoir. Our brain protects us from certain memories. And so there are ways to access, and sometimes what you don't remember or can't remember is the most interesting, or what you misremember. Why our brains protect us, I think, is also fascinating. So if somebody's memory is different than mine about something, it doesn't mean mine is wrong or theirs is wrong. The question of why? Why did we go through the same thing and have different, why did we remember different things, is fascinating. That's what I think makes memoir so interesting.
Well, there's that adjacent thing to memoir too called journal writing, right? Mm-hmm. And what you may, I mean, I've been keeping journals since I was six years old.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I can go back and read that and I think to myself, that wasn't how it was, you know? And which one of us told the truth? 6-year-old Alicia or this-year-old Alicia, you know? So it's very interesting. I think one of the things, I just want to actually pause for a second because I want to acknowledge that the sentence that you read was one that got caught in my throat when I first read it. In addition to being a long sentence that feels rushed, and I mean that as a compliment, you know, it was a very, you know, powerful sentence. And I want to also say that there was something that you wrote that I actually had never thought of. I mean, there are many things that all of you wrote that I'd never thought of in my life, but there was one that you wrote, Kelly, that really stuck with me, and it was talking about your husband and saying, it's not really him I'm leaving, but who I thought I could be. I'm grieving a version of myself that I believed in. I thought that was a real revelation because it took the onus off of the other person in a way. I'm sure, you know, there's another way we could talk about this too, but I wanted to acknowledge that because it's such a self-probing and kind of self-kind thing to say. The other thing that was really resonant in your work and actually in everyone's work was landscape, as you mentioned. I'm just going to elide for a second and call it setting, which is so important to the work that you do. You've acknowledged that. And I mean, where would your story be, Curtis, without Detroit, right? I mean, it's such, Detroit is so alive in your descriptions of Detroit and everything around the sounds and, you know, the music, all of it is there. And Josh, you're all over the world. Yours is kind of, it's like memoir travel log, you know. So, but Kelly, I was wondering if you, if your piece that you want to read has a landscaped element to it, or if you have one that might help us with that. If you don't, that's fine.
You know what? Sure. I was going to read the beginning because Curtis read the beginning, but I can I could switch that.
Okay.
So my former partner is an artist, a painter, and so a lot of this book is about reclaiming my own identity as an artist and understanding. I tried in three small lyric essays to inhabit the space of an artist looking at a canvas, and so that's what these are meant to be. It's one of them. So there are three still lifes, I call them, and this is still life to the country. There is the father at the easel. There is the mother at the kitchen sink. There are the children in the field, in the tire swing, in the raspberry tangles, hands full of mud, of baking flour, of wildflowers. The outside never shuts off. Soundtrack, the frog opera. Hysterical turkeys. The hard huffs of deer in the woods, the original pranayama. The bobcats yowling, coyotes crying, the barn swallows chattering overhead. The clomp of boots on the porch, the plaintive yawn of a screen door's springs, the desperate blinks of fireflies, look at me, look at me, look at me. The sheer quantity of green is like an assault. Spring explodes in new green and sap green and leaf green. Summer is parched and the greens are sucked dry, crumbling into ochres and golds. Autumn is swamp green, heavy, viridian, and Verona. Winter goes slick with glassy jadeite, a mix of cobalt and underwater gray, rare green earth. Through it all, buzzards and hawks make Mars black swirls in the sky, terrifying in their slowness. We are careless. We kill deer with our vehicles, grass with our urine, bees with insecticide. We break lawnmowers and tractors and dryers, sump pumps and generators and swings. We break water pipes, windows, walls with fists. We break promises, confidences, each other's hearts. The day after a surprise storm, I come upon a contractor bucket filled with a few inches of rainwater. There's a bird floating perfectly at the top, flat, with a wing extended, chromatic black like a Carrie James Marshall painting. No eyes, no features, just silhouette. When I look into the water, I'm startled. For a moment, the bucket is a wishing well. The dead bird, my reflection, my prophecy.
Thank you. Thank you so much. These interstitial moments that Kelly writes in this book are so poetic. And that's not to say the other writing isn't poetic, but it's a very different voice. I almost felt like you were engaging in more of a fiction-y sound with those. You know, it's very interesting to find that in interspersed throughout the book, and quite a lovely interlude between elements. Curtis, I want to come to you for just a second because I want to follow up on this. What do you remember? You just said at the beginning it took you 10 years to write this, and there's a lot of history in this, a lot of historical details in this. Could you talk about the role of research that's outside of your personal story that is absolutely necessary in a memoir like yours?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think everybody has a different type of memory. And for me, I'm very visual, so I remember scenes very, very well, and I remember dialogue to some degree. What I wasn't as good about was like remembering what happened first, like time-wise. And so a lot of that was just reconstructing it. Because the other thing about my book is that it's a love letter to Detroit, right? I mean, it really captures all the pivotal moments. Anybody here from Detroit? You know, Okay, cool. So like when Hudson's department store closed down, or when we had Devil's Night, or when the Tigers won the World Series, it's all interwoven, and it's how you see this Chinese-American experiencing these things. Or when the Republican convention came to town, it's, you know, and so I really wanted to weed that in, because a lot of times when we look at Asian-American stories, it's very disconnected, right? Or it's not as tied into the fabric of America, and that was really important for me to sort of build that in. And so I did have to do a lot of research. I had to confirm dates. I had to make sure that the timeline, you know, all made sense. So maybe that's why it took too long.
I don't think there is a too long. Okay. You know, I think you left out a couple pivotal ones, which is the rise of AIDS, which is in the backdrop of this, and also these tensions that are not just Asian American that are happening around you that are really integral to your experience.
Yeah,
you know?
Vincent Chin murder. I don't know if people know the Vincent Chin murder, but my uncle was his best man. I mean, that was a really pivotal experience growing up. It really, for people who don't know, he was a Chinese, this was the height of the anti-Japanese sentiment of the car industry at that time, and he was a Chinese-American out celebrating his upcoming wedding. These two white auto workers come in, and they're overheard saying, it's because of you mother blanks that were out of work. They get thrown out of the bar, and these two guys literally get in their car, and they drive around the city of Detroit until they see him sitting outside of McDonald's waiting for his ride to pick him up, and they take a baseball bat out of their car and they bash his head and they kill him. And to make matters worse, the judge only fined them $3,000. They never served a single day in jail. And the judge's rationale was, you don't put these type of people in jail. What type of people are you talking about? You know, people with left hands? I don't know. But it was and because he was a family friend, it really just, you know, was just something that really stuck in my head and very, very pivotal in terms of me wanting to be a writer. I actually talk about that because, you know, even though it was such a horrendous crime and he suffered, he was in the hospital for 4 days fighting for his life, the media never covered that story for a whole 12 days, you know. And then after that one article appeared, it took another 10 months. And I just kept thinking, you know, it's like, why is nobody telling our story? Why is no one telling the Asian American experience, right? And that's what got me interested in writing. It's like, well, if nobody else is going to write it, I'm going to start writing myself. So, yeah, you know, these larger events sometimes inspire us, you know, to pick up the pen.
Well, I also think that books like yours, as if there is another book like yours, but anyway, books that talk about the experiences that you've had are also inspiring young people. You know, I work with a lot of young artists. They're very upset that they don't see Asians represented in musical theater or on Broadway in any way, and they're doing it.
Yeah.
You know, they're really doing it. So, you know, thank you for helping to be part of getting that voice to us, you know, and making it more mainstream in our American life.
Yeah, Asian Americans are on a pretty good run lately, like last few years.
Right.
A lot of stuff happening, so it's really exciting. So, yeah.
And Josh, you're all over the world in this book, and, you know, your book has a different kind of urgency to it. Like, I can feel you having to get this out as you make your journey. And is it someplace in the book or someplace else that I read where you said, I was writing these and sending them to my friend and sending these chapters to my friend? Was this a quickly written book?
No, it wasn't quickly written. It was written over a couple of years, but I think tying back to both what Kelly and Curtis were saying before in terms of memory and trying to think about this retrospective and how do you end up writing a memoir, one of the things, that urgency that you're talking about, Alicia, that I wanted to capture something that I felt I hadn't seen in other memoirs, which was this kind of messiness that is the lived experience of being in a moment itself. And I think one of the things that typically happens in memoir is people look back from quite a distance at, say, possibly their youth or some other period of their life, and in the looking back, they've already processed in many ways that experience, or perhaps they do process it over the course of writing, but there's a kind of knowingness or an understood understanding of the past. And what I felt so much in beginning this memoir, I started writing it when it was only 9 months after I had discovered that this relationship had taken place between Luciana and Mohammed, the man that she met on the beach. And the experiences that I was going to, by that time, 9 months in, I had flailed in New York, I had kind of fallen apart, I had tried to begin to reconnect or connect with other people, to begin to just find a way to frankly get yourself up. You know, I'd started to try and run, even during the winter, on my back, looking up at the trees with no leaves, and trying to just find some kind of inner strength. But I was still very much at the point that I started writing the memoir, things still felt very much a chaotic kind of situation at that time. And I wanted to begin writing a memoir before I had lived even all the experiences that I ended up writing about. And it was precisely because that messiness, that to me felt authentic. It felt like this is, when you're saying, when do you know that you have something, maybe for an audience out there, I wanted to catch the authenticity of going through that shock and that falling apart, and then using the memoir as a way to become a kind of vehicle to find some way out of that and to rebuild myself. And with even that kind of Pollyanna-ish, and originally I had this ridiculous idea that I would, you know, just call this book in my mind, I just had it as Happiness. Okay, What a ridiculous thing to put as kind of a title in your mind, and it sounds, I mean, this book is not always a happy book, but it's a slow process of recovery, the kind of slow process of recovery that real recovery is. And so over the course of writing it during 2 years, I would live things. For example, a friend invited me out to El Paso. I went out to El Paso. I had incredible experiences in many of the LGBTQ nightclubs there with him. My friend was gay. Then I found out he's an alcoholic. It was difficult. That wasn't going to be the place to recover. A friend of his comes into town. She's working in the embassy in Mexico City and offers me a place to write. So I go to Mexico City and I start experiencing things there and start falling in love with a painter who I call Monica in the memoir. And then I start writing as I live with Monica about the falling in love. And then, so I kept living things and then writing about them not too long after I had lived those things. So that by the end of the memoir, I go to Morocco. I won't say much about the encounter that I ultimately had with Muhammad, but then I ended up in Italy. And when I'm in Rome, by the end, I had just been with Muhammad. And I'm writing about those things when I was there. So I think there are a lot of different ways in which we can come into memoir in terms of the distance. How far after the experience do you want? But always rooted, as you're saying, in that kind of setting and all these places that I was going to.
Oh my gosh, Josh, I'm so interested to hear you say you wanted to call it Happiness, because I wanted to call it Anger. And, you know, and I think that runs through it. Like, you are pretty freaking angry in this book.
And I start angry. Yeah. It's a book that starts in a place of anger, as I think anyone who honestly encounters that kind of experience would. But I believe strongly that by the end of the book, that's certainly not the place that I'm at. It's a very different emotional space, so much so that, I mean, I don't really want to give away too much about the encounter with Muhammad, but I think one thing that felt very powerful to me is that I could meet him and very intentionally not feel anger after that encounter. And so that seemed vital to get to that potential point where it almost didn't even matter if I had met Muhammad by the time I got to him. The anger that you know, that by 2 years later we're in a very different place. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, I think that, you know, I often think of memoirs as somebody done somebody wrong books, you know, and that kind of propels you forward, whether it's someone who breaks your heart or whether it's a parent or whether it's someone who dies, you know, like there's something that happens that feels wrong done to you. And I felt that, Kelly, in your book as well, that there was a wrongness that you were grappling with and therefore an underlying anger. And certainly, Curtis, there are many moments of anger in your book as well. It's more social, but more social anger. It's more social anger, okay. You know, like, and not, you know, the stuff with your parents is kind of like parents, you know, I don't really sense that, even though you fight with them or whatever, but the anger is really about justice.
Oh, okay, yeah.
And that does, so there are different forms of anger in each of your books. I mean, maybe the divorce book has a little, the two of you, Josh and Kelly, have a little bit more overlap with that. But I wonder if you think that anger was a propelling element, and we're going to move on to the question, so we need to move quickly through this. Is anger a legitimate way to begin a memoir? That's just kind of a yes or a no.
I'll just quickly answer. Yeah. You know, I have a line in my joke. My family's Buddhist, and we don't understand anger. We're supposed to let it go. And so after Vincent Chin was murdered, like, I didn't know how to process that feeling. And it was the mayor of Coleman Young, the first black mayor of Detroit, who was one of our regular customers, who said, no, you have to understand anger. And anger is something that could be used for good. And I even to this day, I'm not really sure how to deal with anger because I'm told not to have it. So I don't know. Yeah.
Got it, Kelly. Mm-hmm.
I'll say I completely understand why you wanted to call this happiness. I think I do. Because there was a moment in a draft that I sent in to my editor, right? And that's why we need editors, where I say a lot of the place I read from is a farmhouse in rural Pennsylvania. It's bucolic, it's beautiful, but a lot of terrible things happen there. And I wrote, it was the place I was happiest. And my editor said, wait, you just spent 200 pages telling us why you were unhappy there. And I realized, right, it's where I thought I could be my happiest. I never was actually that. Mm. And that's for me where the anger came in. I was angry to have lost that chance. And I think when I was able to move that anger away from directing it toward, you know, my ex or even to me, I try to be gentle with myself in here. And it just, you're just bereft. Some things don't work out and there is no one to blame. And I think that's sometimes harder.
Yeah,
for sure. I think the thing is, whether it's anger or whatever emotion, it's the honesty that we do have to begin with when we're writing memoir. So, you know, this memoir, some people, writers I really admire, like Andre Debussy III, he's called it a brave, and it's a word that keeps coming up when people are describing Wonder Travels. And I think it's simply the willingness to be honest about the emotions. I mean, we are people who can certainly get angry, and I think if we're at all successful in our memoir, what we're really allowing ourselves to do is to look at both our weak, I don't want to say our weaker sides, but the totality of ourselves as a human being, both the parts that we wish people might admire in us and the other parts that maybe are less admirable about ourselves, and put those both, all of that, on the page.
Got it. Thank you all for those answers. Okay, we're going to open up questions from the audience, and it's very critically important that you use the microphones that are set up. I just want to remind you, it's an accessibility issue so that everyone can hear what you have to say, but it's also for the recording that's being made for the Boston Book Festival. So there are mics right here in the front and also in the back. If you can't get to a mic, please raise your hand and we'll have someone bring it to you. But the floor is open. Yes. Do you have a question, Chris? Okay, good. Okay, go ahead and come to the mic. There's one right behind you. Yeah. Thank you.
As I listen to you, I'm thinking about the relationship between journalism and memoir. And I'm very curious about, perhaps you didn't begin with journals, maybe it's all in your head, but if you did begin with journals, what do you see as the difference? What's the difference to you, if there is one?
So maybe one of you could take that question if one of you feels...
I'm happy. I think the thing about journaling is that by its nature, it's something private, right? It doesn't mean that it couldn't be intelligible or of interest, but in a way, it's a private code. It's sometimes shorthand, and it's where perhaps people... as they put down their own experiences, I don't journal. I should say this before as I'm responding. And I think one of the things that anyone who writes is we're not journaling, no matter what, when we're writing memoir or when we're writing fiction, because we're seeking to write something that we can all share really the same experience. You pick up, one of the amazing things about writing is that it's always an act of translation in the sense that we put these words on the page and you as readers can pick up those words and understand really very close the experience that we've had. And journaling can't do that necessarily because that act of translation gets cut off. okay, in a lot of ways. And so what we do when we put forward, whether it's memoir or fiction, we're putting forward experience, of course, that we've edited a lot. I mean, it doesn't have just necessarily the roughness of journaling, but it might have the energy, hopefully, of a journal or the honesty of a journal, but it's something that ultimately that is converted into art. And art is an intensification of experience. It's not just the experience itself. It becomes a more, think of a painting that you've seen. The colors are not exactly the same as what you see out in the world. It's something more vibrant, has some more energy. So that's what we do when we transform, say, our own experience into something that's beyond just a journal, into something that is art, hopefully.
Thank you, Josh. Go ahead.
I have a question for Kelly. You had said that sometimes you stop and you notice that you're hiding in a page, mm-hmm. and that the editor helps you notice that. And I was wondering, what are the techniques to unearth yourself from that hiding?
That's a great question. I think fear motivates writing and not writing. I don't believe in writer's block. I think it is simply when we're not being truthful on the page, often we get clogged and stop. For me, actually, would be the answer to the first question, journaling, because it's private. I do journal and have also since I was six. And in the beginning of the book, I say actually that if there were a fire in my house, my journals are the thing that I would take first. And I think that's not out of, I know what happened to me, right? I know what my life, I know I have those memories stored, but it's exactly the idea of going back and being able to see the chronology of, wait, oh, that happened before and after and make sense of it. I think journaling in the same way that when you arrive to a piece of, or if you open, depending on how you write, a clear piece of paper or an open piece of paper, or you open a Word doc and it's just blank, there's nothing more terrifying. And for me, it's about tricks. So what I like to do, for example, is write a poem. If I can't figure out what I'm trying to say in essay form, I will switch modes and either go to my journal, write a poem. Another thing I like to tell my students to do is write in three-word sentences. Tell me your story in three-word sentences. And your brain gets so focused on, oh, wait, is that four words or three words? Oh, okay. And then suddenly the part that was afraid, the action isn't, you can't feel the fear because you're doing your homework assignment, right? And so another thing that I like to do is simply take an index card, because, and I love your index cards, and write the sentence that feels the scariest. What is the thing that you are so afraid to write? Write it down. And then you can flip it over and say, what am I actually afraid of? Because chances are that's not the thing. And I know for me, for my first book, there was a sentence that I was so terrified to write, but it felt so important. And ultimately, I wound up not even keeping that sentence in because it was what came after. It was what I made of that sentence, of that fear, that was actually the important part.
It sounds like you're saying that's the thing that is the blockage,
yes.
Not the thing that you need to do.
Yes.
Kelly, I keep my journals in a fireproof box. Just want to let you know, that's the only thing in my house
right?
That's in a fireproof box. More questions, go ahead in the back. Thank you.
So this is sort of a technical question also for Kelly, or any, if either of you, any of you write essays. I'm also trying to write a memoir in essays. Oh God! But it's hard because it feels like it's in some ways memoir feels a little easier because you're just like I'm telling the story in a sort of sequential way or like, but I feel like essays tend to be more organic and mm-hmm. like you said like they're inspired by two things or so I'm wondering like how you accomplished like did you have the idea for the book. And then you were like, I'm going to form it into essays as they come to me, as I'm inspired. Or like, how did you do it?
However
you want to answer.
Yeah, sure. I wish that's how I did it. I think even if it were a straightforward memoir, it probably still would have began and ended in different places. For me, my experience of leaving, of the end of a marriage, and maybe Josh can speak to this too, or leaving home, right? It's not chronological. I think there are certain things, mostly this is a book about grief, nostalgia. There's a book that really broke open my brain called The Suicide Index by Joan Wickersham. Some things are not chronological, and the more truthful way into that story for me was to take a layer and dive deep into it and then come back out. And it's mostly chronological, but I certainly didn't write them chronologically, and I would say I wound up flipping the order of certain pieces because there are parts, you know, it's a jumble of maybe 20 years, but they crisscross and they crisscross within each other. But the sort of feeling from the first sentence, which I wrote the first essay last, because only then, once I got to the end, did I understand what I was doing. Hopefully the goal would then be in the same, bless you, the same way that you do at the beginning of an essay, of each essay, is when you go back and you know what your question is, right? Not what the answer is, but what your question is, that you are pulling your arrow back and releasing it from that first sentence all the way to the end. And each essay should be building on that trajectory in some way. And that the narrator needs to change, and that change should be charted, right? Within each, but across the whole spectrum. Does that help?
Okay. Do either of you want to say something about that?
She's the professor.
Okay. Another question. Oh, do you want to?
No, Curtis. I didn't know if Curtis had something you wanted to say.
No, that was it. That was my joke.
Yeah, we haven't really mentioned Curtis's sense of humor in his book, but I do want to mention that because it's kind of a fun read that way. Yeah. More questions. This is an opportunity for those of you who did raise your hand to find out more about memoir. Go ahead, sir.
Hi. I was struck by Josh, you're talking about distance between when, and I was wondering, being a novelist, if you gave it more distance, would you have written a novel covering these experiences? And maybe you will in the future, but yeah.
I never even contemplated writing this story as a novel. I have published a novel and a couple collections of short stories. One of the reasons why is that it just felt to me that at one point when I finished this memoir, someone said, well, what if you called it autofiction, right? Which is something that has become a kind of genre unto itself now. And I resist that for a couple of reasons. One reason is that I think it really does matter whether we've experienced something or not. Right, it really does matter if we've gone through a certain struggle or not, and it also matters if we. One of the challenges of writing memoir is to really hold yourself so accountable to the best truth that you can. Mm-hmm. Understanding, as Kelly said earlier, the subjectivity that we only have our point of view, but once you insist that, okay, I'm writing something, I'm not going to enhance something or increase the drama of it as you might do in, say, quote-unquote autofiction or as you might in a novel, then what you're left with is not a drama that you can increase or diminish to suit some artistic end. You're left with your own life and trying to figure out, okay, so where is the interest of the story going to come from then? And I think at that point it comes from, rather than in a way with a novel in which it may be outside to some extent the self, it's going incredibly deeply inside with memoir. Because the facts are kind of set, what you have to do to go into is to really get to the understanding of your own motivations, why you did something, who you really were as you went through something, which you probably don't know before you sit down to write. You have a constructed version of yourself that you tell yourself, and you have your knowledge of what the experiences are that you've lived. But until you kind of recreate them, you haven't necessarily started to get into the details that are revealing. And it's as the subconscious brings up when we're writing, right? When we're writing, all sorts of parts of our subconscious come out as we're describing setting, as we're describing how we interact with other people. And as we start to tap into that, we start to see the truth of what we act, who we actually are and what we actually lived. So the drama for me comes from that. And there's the cropping then of, say, of experience in memoir that's very different from, say, a novel. So I wouldn't do that with this book, and I would only do it if, you know, something truly dramatic happened in my life. And I'm just finishing a new memoir, and because of some other quite big thing that happened, and I like to say, I hope this is the last memoir I'll write, because I don't want the drama anymore, you know?
And
I'll be relieved when I can just go back to, quote unquote, making things up, which of course fiction does draw on our personal experience. But
gosh, Josh, that was so interesting. And I think it's worth pointing out too that all three of our speakers are educators, and I feel like I got a small lesson there. Thank you. Thank you for that.
It's... Curtis gets to call me the professor.
Okay. Professor.
No, I mean, it is.
The dean, how about that?
So we could probably take one more question if you'll go to the mic, and while you make your way there, I will say there will be a book signing with Josh and Kelly after this. And what will happen with your book, Curtis?
Unfortunately, something happened with the shipment. So I will be there. I will sign, I guess, what do they call them? Cards?
Book plates
or something. Yes. But I'm also coming back to town next Sunday. I'll be at Porter Square Books in Cambridge. And then I'll be at the Athenaeum on Tuesday. So please come. And if you want to come on Tuesday and you want to come for free, I have a secret code to get you in for free.
There will be books. So
there will be books of those two things.
I think we're going to...
And they are. You can't order books here from Trident, so at least come and say hi to me. Yeah.
So our last question for the day.
Thank you. This has been wonderful. So I have a question for all three of you. As Kelly mentioned, you write from your memory. How did your families or the people that were affected in this book, how did they react to your book, and how did you process that if they come from a completely different perspective? Like, how did you navigate all that?
I can answer that. Well, so first of all, my family hasn't read the book yet, so we'll see how they respond. But I do like to share this one story about writing about family. Is that so? I've been doing all these pre-readings like for the last few months, and I was down in Austin, Texas, reading. And you're from Texas?
Yes.
Okay. Well, this is a Texas story. So the organizers called and said, "Hey, we're having brunch early. Do you want to come down and join us?" And so okay. So I go downstairs to wait for the Uber to pick me up. And there's an old Chinese lady standing right on the corner, and she's stretching. And she turns around, and she sees my sweatshirt that says Detroit versus Everybody. And so she asks me, "Oh, are you from Detroit?" And I'm like, "Oh, yeah." And we start talking, and it turns out that her mom was best friends with my grandmother. And in my book, my grandmother's kind of the villain, right? And so this woman is, like, sharing all these stories about my grandmother, saying, "Oh, she's such a nice person. She's so great. She had candy in her pocket. She taught me how to drink American coffee." And I'm, like, thinking, this is not the same woman I know. At some point, I just had to say, look, you obviously have different memories, and I'm glad someone likes my grandmother, but it's just not me because I had a different relationship. And so I finally managed to escape because the Uber ride arrived. But then I thought about this 2 days later. I was like, maybe that was my grandmother sending an emissary from the grave saying that you misrepresented me. And so I say, no matter what you write about your family, even if they're dead, they're not going to like it. So just write whatever you want.
Yeah,
so.
This is the grandmother that has the bloody knife in her hand.
The bloody knife, who used to call me Mo Young, like useless, like all the time. Yeah, no.
Yeah, right. So she's not quite a character.
Yeah, she's the villain in the book, sorry.
Yeah. Go ahead, Kelly.
So as you might imagine, often when I would tell people what I was writing about, people would say, what about your children? What if they read it? And so I want them to read it. I wrote this book so they could read it. I think that always seemed like a sort of a silly question because they were there. Hmm. There's nothing they don't know. They don't know my
reaction or what was happening with me, but I don't see why that would be harmful to them. And they came to readings, and what I did do in the writing of it was my goal, they're the only readers that really matter to me in that way, to protect, because I can't write this book without them being on the page too, and I wanted, it was very important to me to protect them in so much that they could, at any point in their lives, choose to either participate or not. So to leave enough space so that they understand that this is my story, this is not the story, this is not their story, that they have their own, their father will have his own, and that I'm excited to understand their story as well.
I think, you know, I don't know, for example, if Luciana has read or will ever read this memoir, but I think it's very hard on family members in general when you write a memoir. And one of the things is you're putting yourself so much with your warts and all on the page. And I think, I know my mom is uncomfortable reading this memoir. And you know, but the thing is, I've really put myself naked in many ways on the page. And if I can face that and have that, at some point it ceases to be about us as the writers. Mm-hmm. It becomes, it's our life, but it's a life that hopefully is honestly portrayed so that we don't have to be embarrassed about these difficult things that we've lived because we've put them now on the page. And so I feel like my family doesn't have to be embarrassed. No one does. It's simply something honest that we can all share together at some point then on the page. Thank you all for coming.
Yeah, thank you, Josh, Kelly, Curtis, and thank all of you.